You're listening to the Faces of Armenia.
People want a better life. And a better life doesn't just mean materially. Okay, you can buy off people occasionally, but they also want to be free. They want to live peacefully. They want to develop. They want to share in the glories and diversities of the world. They want to travel. And Azerbaijanis, given all the wealth of that country, they also want that as well. But what has happened, in fact, is an elite, a small elite, oligarchic elite, led by Ilham Aliyev, controls the country and enriches its own cronies. So there has to be a democratic movement. The West should be supporting this in Azerbaijan.
This and more in today's episode.
Ladies and gentlemen, dear friends of Faces of Armenia, today we welcome you to another special series on Artsakh with the esteemed historian Ronald Suni. But before we start, a quick note on Faces of Armenia's special series, in which we offer experts from a variety of disciplines a platform to share their perspectives and reflect upon Nagorno-Karabakh. We truly believe that our distinguished guests will contribute to the substance of the ongoing discussions, strengthen mediating forces, both of which will hopefully contribute their part to find a timely and agreeable end to the war. We, Faces of Armenia, see ourselves as a bridge between Armenia and the international community, calling the latter to engage productively and support effectively. With that being said, I guess it's time to start. Dear Ronald, if you can give us some details to your background, to your person, to your personality.
Thank you, Constantine, for inviting me. My name is Ronald Grigor Suni. I was born in the United States, in Philadelphia, of Armenian parents. My mother was also born here in Philadelphia. My father came from Tbilisi, from Georgia, and migrated with his family as a little boy in the early 1920s. So I grew up in an American household, more or less, speaking English primarily. In those days, it wasn't fashionable to be ethnic, so I was taught English. I had to learn Armenian later in graduate school, but was surrounded by grandparents and others and learned a lot about Armenia. There was, at the time in my family, no bitterness about Turkey or much talk about the genocide. My grandmother on my mother's side, Aznif Tashjan Kezdekian, had come from Diyarbakir, which is now in Turkish Kurdistan. And she did talk about earlier massacres, the Hamidian massacres. My grandfather on my mother's side, Avedis Kezdekian, came from Yozgat in central Turkey. And he did also refer to massacres, the 1909 infamous massacres, pogrom in Adana in the Ottoman Empire. So on one side, Turkish Armenian relatives, on the other side, Russian Armenian relatives. And around the dinner table, my father would always talk about his history, about being in the Caucasus when the Bolsheviks came to Tbilisi and how they left. His father was a Dashnag, an Armenian nationalist, and so it was useful to leave Georgia once it became Soviet. He came eventually through Turkey to America and became quite enamored of Soviet Armenia, which was now the Armenia that we had. And I developed in that household, learning about the Soviet Union, hoping that the Soviet Union would become truly socialist and democratic, which ultimately didn't happen. And when it tried finally under Gorbachev, it all fell apart. And so eventually I was hired at the University of Michigan as professor of Armenian history, the Alex Manukyan Professor of Modern Armenian History, taught here. Then was hired at the University of Chicago in political science, spent some 11 years there, and then returned to Michigan now as I'm now the William H. Sewell Distinguished Professor of History and Professor of Political Science at the University of Michigan. I'm the author of, lots of books. Every time people introduce me, they say, well, we can't go through all these books, but maybe the most relevant ones for this conversation are a book called They Can Live in the Desert, But Nowhere Else, A History of the Armenian Genocide, which was published by Princeton University Press in 2015 on the 100th anniversary of the massacres and deportations, the Armenian Genocide, a century ago. And more recently, I've been working on a book on nationalism, have written several books on the Soviet Union, and with my colleague Valerie Kivelson, a book called Russia's Empires. So I've been stuck or embedded in this area of the Caucasus and of Turkish history, Russian history, Ottoman history, Soviet history for the last, 50 years.
And so a quick note. So I personally also read the thesis of Arnold J. Toynbee from the 50s, I believe. And he wrote on the Armenian genocide. And this is a great resource also to see how horrific the Turks went with their incentive to eradicate or more likely exterminate even the Armenian race. So it really puts some tears in your emotional being. I really have to strengthen this also. Before we continue with the conversation, could you also provide a little account or a short story, what it meant for you to grow up being Armenian or in an Armenian household?
Yeah. So you have to understand that when I was a little boy in the 1940s and then a teenager in the 1950s, it was not fashionable in the United States to be ethnic. This was a period of still some anti-Semitism, a Jim Crow, the repression of African Americans, and everybody wanted to be real Americans. So my parents gave us English names. I was Ronald. My sister was Linda. We were not taught our language, that is Armenian, even though in the household they spoke Armenian when they wanted us not to understand what they were talking about. But there still was a very Armenian aspect. And I grew up, I would say, with a kind of double distancing from the United States. So on the one hand, I knew that we were Armenian and they over there were American. Right, my grandmother would say to me, "Mink hayenk, we're Armenians. Anunk, Amerikatsian, they are Armenian. They are American. So we're Armenians. They are Americans." And then I'm thinking, as a little boy, wait a minute. We live in America, but we're not. We're Armenians. And then she would say, "Anunk odaren." In other words, the Americans were the foreigners. Odar, the other. So there I was living in America, realizing we were very special Armenians, and those Americans were really foreigners. So I had this kind of distant, nice relationship with America, which has served very well, because as a historian, I can be affectionate about America, but also feel a certain alienation or distance or objectivity or neutrality about the country I was born in and live in. And at the same time, on my father's side of the family, it was a very left-wing family. It was very pro-Soviet. So there we were hopeful that the Soviet Union would become truly socialist, democratic, progressive. And I was growing up in the Cold War times when the Soviet Union was demonized. This was a time of Stalin, of repression, of tyranny. And the Soviet Union was the major enemy of the United States. So I became very interested in the Soviet Union, in Soviet Armenia, in the history of the Caucasus, to find out what was this country about? What was it doing? This country that had won the Second World War in Eastern Europe, that had fought and defeated three quarters of the Nazi armies that had invaded the Soviet Union, that had liberated Auschwitz, that had ended the Holocaust, that history of the Soviet experience was largely forgotten, their contribution. So I was interested in that. Now, I both had a critical attitude. I wasn't Soviet, but I was really interested. And so I think that served me well to try to write about the Soviet Union, but without a kind of Cold War-ish kind of approach. And then when I got to do my dissertation research, you tell me if I'm going on too long. But
No. Please, continue.
When I got to do my dissertation research, I was interested in combining these interests. So I found there was an Armenian, Stepan Shaumyan, who had been the leader of the socialist movement, the Bolshevik movement, that is what became communist, in the city of Baku, the capital of what is today Azerbaijan. So what an interesting thing. An Armenian, the leader of a revolutionary movement in the city that is now the capital of Azerbaijan. So I did my research in Armenia, a little bit in Azerbaijan, in Moscow, in the 1960s. And I wrote my first book called The Baku Commune, 1917-1918, Class and Nationality in the Russian Revolution. And in that book, I demonstrated that the city of Baku was a multicultural city, lots of Russians, lots of Armenians, lots of Muslims, people who would later be called Azerbaijanis, Muslims, they were then called Tatars, many of them were Persian. It was a very mixed city. And so I was very interested in the workers' movement, the socialist movement, and then how that class movement of the first revolutionary year, the year of 1917, turned into a nationalist conflict between Armenians and Russians on one side and the Muslims on the other side. So I was very much involved in that history. Sadly, that experiment by these Bolsheviks in Baku failed in 1918. The leaders like Shaumyan fled to Central Asia, and there they were murdered by local peoples, anti-Bolsheviks, maybe aided by or at least winked at, not protested by, the British who were in that area at the time. So that was the story.
So you brought up a very interesting point, which I would briefly like to explore before we go into the historical aspects. So you mentioned that around the 50s, 60s in the US, it was not fashionable to disclose your ethnicity. So in general, the popular sources say that Armenians around the world have not really assimilated, are very distinct. However, in America, they became very much Americans, and possibly also because of the policy of ethnic non-disclosure. So what impact did it have on Armenia in itself that Armenians, the second largest diaspora in America, did really assimilate in a way?
So in America, as I mentioned, Armenians were not discriminated against. No one knew who we were. Are you Australian? What is this Armenia? Where is it? Armenians in America very quickly from coming in the 1920s or earlier as refugees, as victims of the genocide in Turkey, very quickly became middle class, much like the Jews, another diaspora, became successful. The man who founded my chair, Alex Manukyan, became very wealthy and then endowed our program here at the University of Michigan. So that was a success story. And they assimilated very quickly. 90% of Armenians in my youth were marrying non-Armenians. I happened to have found a wonderful Armenian woman, a former student of mine, Armina Marjorossian. And we did get married, and our children have Armenian names, because what's happened is in this next generation, we went back to our ethnicity. And so my wife was quite patriotic, we would say, Hayra Naser in Armenian. And she made sure that we gave our older daughter, we had a son, unfortunately, who we lost when he was 2 years old. And we gave him an Armenian name, Grigor, after my grandfather, the musician, ethnomusicologist Grigor Mirzoyan Suni. And then we gave our older daughter Sevan Siranush Suni and my younger daughter Anush Tamar Sunni. So we went back to them, and both girls have learned Armenian. And indeed, my younger daughter, Anush, is an anthropologist who's been studying, in fact, Armenians, Kurds, Turks, their relationship, memory of the genocide. I worked in Van in eastern Turkey, half Turkish, half Kurdish city now, Armenian city up to 1915, but Armenians were massacred or deported or fled from there in 1915. And she did her research there and actually is now married to a Kurd. So we've come back to our roots and to that area. Van was a city of Armenis, of my wife's ancestors.
And very compelling and insightful elaboration, I have to say. And I much like the names of your children.
Yes, Anush means sweet, and Sevan is a lake, the lake.
I've been there. I've been there multiple times. Even though one has to admit, I think, you know, during the Soviet time, unfortunately, Lake Sevan was heavily destructed, polluted, and quote-unquote destroyed, and right now they are fighting against the environmental impact, resurrecting its picturesque beauty.
Yes, it's true that in the Soviet Union was, of course, what you could call a productivist state. They were interested in turning that big continental country and little Armenia from an agrarian village society into an industrial society. And they were not very attentive to the environmental costs of that. There were some protest movements, particularly in the 80s under Gorbachev, to try to save the environment. And that's grown. Actually, it grew into the Karabakh movement in the late 80s, and it still exists. But it's very difficult for a small country like Armenia to both maintain some kind of economic viability and at the same time pay the price of environmental restoration.
And so because your expertise, your field of knowledge is history, I would definitely like to spend disproportionately more time on the topic. And I think we've heard the origins of the conflict again and again, but let's put it a little more into context. Can you medium briefly and describe really the history experience of Georgia, Armenia, and Azerbaijan in the context of the Soviet Union, really starting with the establishment of the Soviet Union? Because I think that would give us an even better foundation to understand the historical rationales of the different actors and players in this conflict.
I'm going to even start back further than that, because the big picture, the way you might look at this in a big general way, is a story of a movement that's gone on in much of the world from empire to nation. So the Armenians in the Caucasus and the people that would become Azerbaijanis, they weren't called Azerbaijanis at first, the peoples of the Caucasus were living between empires in historical times, between the Ottoman Empire, which occupied for much time the western part of the Caucasus, and the Persian Empire, Safavids and others, who were occupying much of the eastern part. So what is today Azerbaijan and what is today Armenia was in the Persian Empire. Eventually, in the early 19th century, Russia came down from the north, annexed Georgia, and eliminated the Georgian monarchs and princes, and eventually took over what is now Azerbaijan, and in 1828 took over what is now Armenia. So the border that was established in roughly 1828 is still essentially the border between Turkey, the Caucasus, Armenia, Georgia, Azerbaijan, and Iran. So it's a pretty stable border there. Now, these empires, Persian, Ottoman, and Russian Tsarist Empire, were all empires, and in the original sense of the meaning, there weren't internal borders. These were not empires that were making homogeneous little nation states within them. The process of demographic movement in empires is mixing of peoples. So people moved around. For instance, the city of Yerevan had a Muslim population right up to the 20th century. The countryside around it was Armenian. And during when there were wars, Armenians would move from maybe from Turkey into what is today Armenia. Muslims would move out. Karabakh, which is this disputed territory, would change hands many times. There were Armenian meliks, little principalities in that area, five of them, before the Russians came. And the original people in that area, if you go back centuries into the Middle Ages, were a people who no longer exist. They're called the Caucasian Albanians. They have nothing to do with Albania today. There were Caucasian Albanians. They had their own language. And eventually those Caucasian Albanians converted to Armenian Christianity. And so eventually many of them, if not most of them, this is a hard thing to talk about, became Armenians, building churches like Armenians and speaking the Armenian language.
That's a very, very good, important observation, I think. So at the time, it was very easy and common to become Armenian. There was no such thing as an exclusionary framework.
Right, right. Because in those days, the most important things before modern times, let's say before the 19th century, the most important thing that identified you was religion, right? So these Caucasian Armenians, many of them, these Caucasian Albanians became Armenians. Other Caucasian Armenians probably became Muslim, not so much in the mountains of Karabakh, but on the plains of Karabakh and elsewhere. Whatever, these are things shrouded in mystery. But the identity was that some people identified now as Armenian Christians, and Karabakh was historically and demographically, in terms of populations, overwhelmingly Armenian. When the Soviets came, it was 90% Armenian.
So, dwelling on this, how many years back, based on verifiable archives or records, does the Armenian population go back in the region of Nagorno-Karabakh?
I would say centuries, probably to the late Middle Ages, right? So we're talking half a millennium. But what's important here, and very important, is that these groups of people live together, that they would sometimes have conflicts, of course, that happens, but that there wasn't the sense of exclusive nationality. People mixed, they intermarried. There was exchanges, there were rapes, there were pillages, there were victories, there were defeats. Some cities would be of one nationality, some countryside of another nationality. It was a complex mixing of peoples. That was the nature of empire, and that's very different from what would happen in the Soviet period and in the post-Soviet period, where you had an unmixing of nationalities and a greater homogenization of population, so that Armenia became 99.9% Armenian. In the late 80s, they drove out, or they fled, the Azerbaijanis who lived in Armenia fled to Azerbaijan. And Azerbaijan became overwhelmingly, except for Karabakh and the areas that the Armenians occupied, became overwhelmingly Azerbaijani. There were hundreds of thousands of Armenians, including my aunt Nune, who lived peacefully with Azerbaijanis in the city of Baku. Well, they look down on those Azerbaijanis, you know, they're Turks of some kind. Armenians are a very proud people, and they often condescend. They even look down on the Russians, calling them soher, onions, because of the onion domes. Armenians have their own pride, and sometimes it's a little offensive and humiliating for the people they live with. In any case, these peoples lived together until the Soviet period, and there was a kind of homogenization of these republics. Armenians from Georgia, many of them moved back to Armenia. Armenians from Azerbaijan moved to Armenia, and so forth. But the big homogenization occurred after the late 1980s, after the fall of the Soviet Union in 1991, when these states became very heavily a single ethno-national state.
So what was the role of the Soviet Union? As you just mentioned, okay, after the fall of the Soviet Union, mono-ethnicity became a concept or a modus right. operandi. But do you think the Soviet Union offered the framework that allowed for mono-ethnicity to, okay, prosper? I know it doesn't sound right, but in a way, I think you get the gist.
I've spent a lot of my career, in fact, investigating exactly these questions, right? So the Soviet Union was a creation of Vladimir Lenin and Joseph Stalin, and it was an ethno-national federation. So there were little republics. There was an independent Armenia, Azerbaijan, and Georgia from 1918 to 1920, 1921. There were three independent states. They were fledgling states. They were weak states. They depended on foreign support to survive. Azerbaijan needed the Ottomans and maybe the British to an extent. The Georgians needed the Germans. And the Armenians needed the Allies, but the Allies were far away and didn't help very much. And so ultimately, all three of these republics became Soviet republics. The Soviet Union formed ethno-national republics, 15 or 16 of these ethno-national republics. And some of them became more ethnically homogeneous, the Caucasus particularly. Others became more Russified. So Ukraine or Belarus or the Baltic countries, Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia, Russians moved in there. So there was various different policies. But for the area we're interested in the Caucasus, there were still mixed populations. So there are lots of Armenians, as I said, in Baku. There are lots of Armenians in Tbilisi, the capital of Georgia. And Armenia was the most ethnically national state. It was about 90%. What's important for our story is that within Azerbaijan, there was an autonomous republic, autonomous oblast or autonomous region called Nagorno-Karabakh, Lernaïn-Karabakh, which means mountainous Karabakh. When the Soviets took over Azerbaijan, one, there were 90% Armenians in that little autonomous region inside Azerbaijan. The Soviets gave that region to Azerbaijan because Azerbaijan was richer than Armenia. It had oil, and many of the roads from Karabakh, from the mountains, moved toward Baku rather than difficult roads to Yerevan.
Okay, then here I may want to interject. That is very relevant, I believe, because most people say, and sure there's a modicum of truth to it, that, okay, Stalin just didn't like the Armenians and he drew some inappropriate borders, which would stir conflict for years to come. So maybe, can you a little bit more elaborate on the negotiations that went on at the time when the Soviet Union ceded Nagorno-Karabakh to Azerbaijan? And also, what was Stalin's personality? Did he actually really not like Armenians? What was his reasoning and rationale?
That's a very good question. Yeah. So, of course, people are going to play on these things. I've read all documents and been in the archives and seen these things. And the story is a little bit complicated, but this is basically what happened. The Bolsheviks came to this area. They had very, very utopian ideas about inter-ethnic peace and harmony. They believed we were moving beyond the age of nationalism. Oh, we'd have to go through nationalism. So we'll have these national republics, but we're moving toward internationalism and international socialist revolution. And so temporarily, they had to deal with this question of an Armenian enclave within Azerbaijan. Now, Lenin's fundamental principle was the idea of national self-determination, that people should determine who their rulers will be, presumably of their own nationality, have rights to their own culture, their own language, their own schools, etc. And the Soviets did that. They arranged a nationality policy that encouraged national cultures, particularly in the Caucasus. As I mentioned, elsewhere there was more Russian influence, but in the Caucasus, Georgia, Armenia, and Azerbaijan became quite national. What about Karabakh? So Karabakh, as I said, 90%, they had to decide what to do with it. And for pragmatic reasons, because Armenia was so poor, it was a land of refugees, of stalking disease. Richard Hovhannissyan, the author of the four volumes on the Armenian Republic, mentioned it. It was flat on its back in 1920-21 when it became Soviet. And Azerbaijan had a better chance. So Stalin was involved in those negotiations. First, they actually gave the little area of Karabakh to Armenia. And then the Azerbaijani leaders, Nariman Narimanov and others, protested. No, 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 this belongs to us. After all, it had been part of Elizavetpol gubernia, province in the Tsarist Empire. So they made their arguments. And eventually, Stalin or Orjonikidze and others conceded and gave that area to Azerbaijan, with the stipulation that Nagorno-Karabakh would be autonomous and would be ruled by the representatives of the local people, the Armenians. But that autonomy was fake. Real sovereignty existed in Moscow and in Baku, and the number of Armenians in Nagorno-Karabakh steadily fell until by the late 80s, it was only 75%. Well, 75% is a pretty significant percentage, but now there were 25% Muslims, Azerbaijanis living there as well. It should also be mentioned that for all the 71 years of Soviet power, of Soviet rule, there was relative peace, a kind of Pax Sovieticus, you could call it, in this area, right? Oh, there was conflict. As I said, Armenians We didn't always love Azerbaijanis. Azerbaijanis didn't always love Armenians, but there was Soviet power there. And if they had a struggle, it might be at the on the football field.
If you can, I think this would be very important now. Can you contrast the Azerbaijani argument for Nagorno-Karabakh, what they cite today, with the facts? Very clear, compare and contrast.
So, the Azerbaijani argument is that this was our territory. Azerbaijan, when the Soviet Union fell apart, possessed Nagorno-Karabakh within its boundaries. And international law in 1991, when the Soviet Union fell apart, decided that the real borders of these 15 now independent republics would be the Soviet borders. And that should not change. Therefore, according to the international community, without dispute, Nagorno-Karabakh belongs to Azerbaijan, according to the principle of territorial integrity. On the other hand, there's another principle, the one the Armenians defend, which is the good old Woodrow Wilsonian and Vladimir Lenin and Soviet constitutional position of national self-determination. That is, people should have the right to rule themselves, particularly if they're a compact ethnic population, to have rights to their language, their culture, and to rulers of their own choice. A very democratic principle. So you've got an international law principle. You've got historical claims that, no, we were here first. No, we were here first. And then you have this principle, which is the most democratic principle of all, of national self-determination. And so it's these war of principles that have led to conflict. Now, what happened was, when the Soviet Union began to fall apart and Armenians began to demand that Nagorno-Karabakh, this ethnic enclave of Armenians, be joined to Armenia, and they demonstrated massively in Yerevan and in Stepanakert for this, Azerbaijanis, sadly, turned to violence. And there was the famous Sumgayit pogrom, which Armenians were killed. And then conflict developed after that. And killing has gone back and forth. And someone will claim, no, Armenians killed Azerbaijanis first. No, Azerbaijanis killed Armenians first. What we know is that there was massive killing first in Sumgayit, then in Baku in January 1990, so-called Black January, where finally Gorbachev sent the troops in. And then Armenians also either drove out, literally put on trucks and drove out Azerbaijanis from Armenia. Many may have fled. And then when the Armenians were winning this conflict in the late 80s and early 90s, they took territory outside of Nagorno-Karabakh, creating about 1 million Azerbaijani refugees within Azerbaijan who were forced to live in camps and hotels and trailers and so forth within Azerbaijan. So you can see that grievances grew, festered, wounds festered for these now two decades of conflict that have existed.
So, but a question that is then interesting. You mentioned in the beginning that Azerbaijanis and Armenians used to interact, used to mingle, used to also have friends beyond their border. How did this hatred, if that is the correct word, institutionalize? How did it become popular? Are there any key events?
Well, the key events of the full hatred, the real anger, fear, and hatred comes at the end of the Soviet period when this conflict develops, because Armenians in Karabakh and in Armenia itself want that area to come to Armenia. So that's when. But before that, of course, there were all kinds of resentments and different kinds of differences. Let me give you a little bit information on that. Armenians have their own mentality. They have a kind of discourse and understanding of their own history. And for Armenians, their history is about tragedy, about victimization, about the genocide of 1915. Many of the people who live in Armenia today, this small republic, were the sons and daughters and grandchildren of refugees who came from Ottoman Turkey after the genocide of 1915. So these are people who have suffered and who have this deep embedded memory. On the Azerbaijani side, very interestingly, I've done a lot of research on this, and this is not well explored. Azerbaijan had what I would call a thin nationalism. It did not have, in the Soviet period and in the late 1980s, a very deep-seated national identity firmly fixed. Azerbaijanis were a new nation. They had been formed in 1918, and then their real development occurred during the Soviet period, when Azerbaijanis gained the name of their nationality, Azerbaijani, when they developed their own leaders. Imagine this, Konstantin. In the period 1926 to 1929, the head of the Azerbaijani Communist Party, the ruling party in the Soviet Republic, was an Armenian, Levon Mirzoyan. Now, if you go into the Wikipedia page of Azerbaijan Soviet Socialist Republic, you'll see the list of all the party bosses, except for that name. It'll be gone. That period is left out, as if the very Wikipedia page is censored, right? So all the Azerbaijanis are there, Narimanov, etc. But this guy, Levon Mirzoyan, who again would have a tragic fate. He went on to be the party boss of Kazakhstan, and then Stalin murdered him in 1939.
But I mean, that proves the importance of history.
Really? Yes.
Because, like, think about it, and I always like to make this argument. Modern, from a modern perspective, we are always oblivious. But when one shows your history, you see a common denominator. So if we would show or make the Azeris aware that they had a great commander-in-chief of Armenian descent, one can tip the soup in favor of Armenia. One can start a process of reconciliation. And what I also briefly want to add here, many people don't know, yet the Germans could have prevented the Ottoman genocide against the Armenians. Many people don't know, and that is a great reason, not for reparation payments, I think that's too politically charged, but for other nations to become involved and to offer support and to foster new friendships. And I think that is what needed in this conflict. So if you can reflect on the relevance of history to not solving, but to offering new perspectives to this conflict.
I'm a historian. I'm a professional historian. I've been doing this for 60 years, if not more. And I think history is what I would call the only database we have to understand where we came from, where we are, and where we might be going. That is, where else are you going to find information, data, that will demonstrate what human beings have been capable of, how these problems and difficulties occur, and how we might get out of it? So history is key. But you shouldn't gloss and make history too harmonious or historical. Real conflicts have always existed. There are resentments. But we also know that empires, some imperial control, occasionally has been not so bad. That is, the Russian Empire, once it conquered the Caucasus, kept relative peace, fostered development. They didn't allow certain things. There was censorship. The Soviet Union was an empire. It also maintained the peace, developed industrial societies, turned people from villagers and peasants into workers, middle-class citizens, etc. Educated these people. More people learned to read and write in Azerbaijani and in Armenian in the Soviet period than ever before in their history. Those societies that are now conflicting with one another have a commonality. They are both heirs of the legacies of the Soviet Union. And as you mentioned, they managed to live together. Okay, not perfectly, not harmoniously, but there was intermarriage. There were people living together. Armenians were very proud to say the best fruits and vegetables in Armenia at the market came from Azerbaijanis. And you'll hear even today, the older generation in some of the bombed out houses in Stepanakert will say, we did live together well, but now it's impossible. Now we can't, because the hatred has become so great.
And then I think you are uniquely qualified to speak to the hatred on both sides. So in this regard, A, was the Black Friday and the Sumgayit pogrom a point of no return, A? And B, can you describe the evolution of hatred in Azerbaijan and contrast it really with the evolution or tendencies to hatred in Armenia, if any?
So there are different emotions at play here, right? One is fear. So fear may be, for the Armenians, the major emotion. And fear can turn into hatred. Fear and anger at what has occurred, can turn into hatred. So anger is an emotion that you feel when someone does something to you bad. And you could sulk, you could fight back or whatever. Hatred is far stronger emotion. And I see that developing now. Hatred is the emotion that it's not what you've done to me, but it's who you are. It's what you are essentially. And therefore, we must eliminate you. Now, when fear and anger turns into hatred, you have an existential conflict. And Armenians are feeling that because they're a small, vulnerable nation. One side is Turkey. The other side is Azerbaijan. They're using advanced weapons they're getting from Turkey, Syrian mercenaries who the Turks have allowed to come in, weapons and drones from Israel, which is also helping Azerbaijan. So this is an existential threat. On the Azerbaijani side, I would say they're slightly different. Now, the hatred is there, fear, but more than anything else, resentment. Resentment is an emotion you feel because someone else got something that you think they shouldn't deserve, but you should have. And there is resentment that how did these Armenians manage to get Karabakh and beat us in a war up to 1994, right? Almost 30 years ago, and get part of our homeland. Now, you know, when I was working on this subject in the 80s, Azerbaijanis were not that attached to Karabakh. It was this sort of foreign enclave. By the way, Armenians weren't that attached to it either. They consider Karabakhis to be sort of rubes, country bumpkins. But eventually, these Karabakh became symbolically important. It became, it's our heartland. For Armenians, losing Karabakh means another genocide. What could be more existentially frightening than that? And for the Azerbaijanis, and manipulated by their authoritarian government under Ilham Aliyev, Karabakh has become a symbol of their homeland. Now, as I said before, Azerbaijanis had a thin nationalism, but the nationalism that developed in Azerbaijan in the late 1980s and 1990s was an anti-Armenian nationalism. So they are defined by their anti-Armenianness, right? And that's very powerful. Azerbaijan is a state that is suffering today from low oil prices, from economic difficulties, from political repression, from discontent from younger people who would like to be freer and more modern and participate. And war is the way that its government can, in fact, divert attention from internal problems in Azerbaijan. This is, by the way, also true of Turkey, into a foreign enemy. It's those Armenians that are causing these problems, right? On the Turkish side, Erdogan is also suffering from a deep economic collapse. And what's he been doing lately? He's got conflicts in Libya, where he's facing the Russians and local warlords. He's in Syria, where he's basically driven out the Americans and his conflict with the Russians. He's in the Aegean Sea, where he's making conflict over oil rights in with the Greeks. And now he's fostering conflict in the Caucasus by supporting Azerbaijan and its aggression against Armenians. Make no mistake. This war began because Azerbaijan wanted to change the status quo. Armenia was occupying a large portion, about maybe 13-15% of Azerbaijan, if you count Karabakh as part of Azerbaijan. And it was satisfied with the status quo. It didn't want to change things. It was happy with that. Maybe it should have compromised, but when it was in control, but it was happy. Azerbaijan was unhappy with the status quo. And so they launched this vicious attack, bombarding cities. If Karabakh and the surrounding areas are actually part of Azerbaijan, then Baku should realize it's shelling, bombing, and using drone warfare against its own citizens. This is like the Georgians who attacked South Ossetia, bombing Tsinvali, its own citizens, supposedly. So this is a brutal internal civil ethnic warfare that's going to be, if it escalates any further, will be devastating for both sides.
So two very valuable points you brought up. You said, yes, there's hatred on both sides. However, the hatred has different origins. On right. The Armenian side, it is fear and anger. While on the Azerbaijani side, it is anger and resentment.
And well put, yes.
If you hypothesize from the Azerbaijani side, the only resolution is complete extermination of Armenia in order to satisfy their feeling of resentment. For Armenia, is they just need security and peace in order for fear and anger to ebb. So now that brings us actually to a very interesting point. So okay, all we need to do is to convert civil society's resentment and anger in Azerbaijan towards only anger or some other negative emotions. Because then you have a negotiation point. Then you have, okay, you're angry, you're scared. Okay, we can resolve this. Resentment is harder to resolve. What do you think about changing the mind as a point for starting negotiation?
Much of the work I was doing in studying nationalism and ethnic conflict through my career has been to combat the easy, facile notion that these conflicts are ancient tribal struggles. that these people have always hated each other. Now, we in this discussion have gone beyond that. We've seen the historical roots. We know there are periods when outside imperial control or other kinds of solutions have managed to keep the peace, right? So now we have a real problem. We don't have that kind of imperial control. Maybe Russia will get involved in this in a way and try to bring this conflict to the end. Russia is the key actor here, of course, that can protect the Armenians and mediate this conflict, as we've seen in the last couple of days, though it's not that successful at the moment. Mm-hmm. But so one should not think, and I think your question is a really good one, that these are indelible, inevitable, essentialist views that can't be changed. They can be changed, and they have been changed in the past, but it's very difficult. Let me add a new element to this that might come to an answer. 2 years ago, in 2018, Armenia had a genuine democratic revolution, right? Pashinyan and his supporters marched from somewhere into Yerevan and overthrew the mafia-like Karabakhsi government. They were ruled by the way, people from Karabakh, right? Kochinyan and these folks. So they got rid of that government. It's a democratic state. Now, that doesn't mean a democratic state can't be nationalistic, but an Armenia is a nationalistic state. The Azerbaijanis are not democratic. They're the one of these three republics that is not democratic. It's autocratic. It's authoritarian. And there is great popular discontent with this government, which is using the oil riches to enrich the rich and to keep the rest of the population under its control. What I would say is the solution, the way out of this, and this is a long shot, is that there has to be a democratic reaction, a democratic move within Azerbaijan. And if there's a democracy in Azerbaijan that can move beyond this hatred, this resentment, this anger, to some kind of peaceful resolution, then it might be possible to have a solution. Many years ago, I and a colleague at the University of Chicago, David Layton, wrote an article that offended a lot of people, that argued, in fact, that you could have a solution if you were willing to compromise. And the solution would be, okay, let's recognize this principle of territorial integrity. Let's agree that Karabakh, in some de jure sense, is within Azerbaijan. But let's also recognize this principle of national self-determination and say that absolutely, realistically, actually, the people of Karabakh must rule themselves. That is, it must be ruled by Armenians. So maybe you'll put a flag over the government building in Stepanakert, which will be Azerbaijani, and it'll be right next to the flag of the Karabakh Autonomous Republic, and you can have a solution. And that would have to include some compensation and some agreement to bring back the Azeri refugees driven out of Karabakh and the surrounding areas so that you can find some kind of long-term peaceful solution. Now, I would be the first to agree that this sounds utopian, but I'm a man of the left. I believe in the possibility of creating constitutional, legal solutions that can solve these problems. It will take a determination and action of the international community, most importantly the Russians in the area, to act as mediators, arbitrators, to try to solve this problem. But it's possible. I believe it's possible. It's the only solution that will work unless these people are going to kill each other.
Okay, to Russia, we'll soon drop a word. And quick comment on my end. 2015, what happened? Germany opened its borders for millions of refugees. Germany had some difficulties coping with it, but more importantly, it showed an extraordinary learning curve of integration, of dealing with multi-ethnic in a mono-ethnic environment, of empowering the newcomers. So therefore, in the international framework, you have the knowledge, you have tools and mechanism that could integrate like two in like ethnicities that used to hate each other. So I think there would be great leeway to experiment with mechanisms to return the Azeri refugees and to have them peacefully or even productively coexist with Armenians if the international community wants to support you. So that's my comment on this. But sure, if you can share your thoughts on this. And also followed, can you help us a little bit better understand Azerbaijan? How is the leadership framework established? Are there any examples of civil courage, civil society? Is there any potential leeway for a semi-democratic transition? How long is the ruler able to sustain economic misery and destruction of the war? So yeah, these two points, and the floor is yours.
So Azerbaijan, because it's a sultanist state, as Max Weber might have put it, a dictatorship, is a rather opaque state. It's hard to get inside to see. I tried to go to Azerbaijan, but they told me we cannot guarantee your safety. So I decided to not do that when I made some tour of the Caucasus a couple of years ago. The Azerbaijanis, really interesting, good people, came to Tbilisi and we carried on conversations. Very productive. There are civil society groups. They are repressed. They are under pressure. There are leftist groups. There are socialist groups. There are democratic groups. There are conservative groups. There are people on the streets who have demonstrated. There have been clashes. These things actually have occurred. In other words, there's a lot of ferment going on underneath. It may be in homes. It may be in clubs. It may be in bars. But they're, what do people want? People want a better life. And a better life doesn't just mean materially. Okay, you can buy off people occasionally, but they also want to be free. They want to live peacefully. They want to develop. They want to share in the glories and diversities of the world. They want to travel. And Azerbaijanis, given all the wealth of that country, they also want that as well. But what has happened, in fact, is an elite, a small elite, oligarchic elite, led by Ilham Aliyev, controls the country and enriches its own cronies and satraps. So there has to be a democratic movement. The West should be supporting this in Azerbaijan. Sometimes the West, including the United States, has played footsie, you can say, has played nice with Azerbaijan, as it does with Saudi Arabia, the Emirates in the Gulf land, etc., because of the oil, right? Or because of some strategic interest. Why aren't we more critical officially in this country about Erdogan or Aliyev or the Saudis? Because there are material and strategic interests at play here. So that means that civil society actors in Armenia, in Russia, in the West, in Europe, in America, have to encourage these struggles against corruption, against authoritarianism, etc. Now, there is one negative possibility that must be mentioned. You gave a very good view of the positive view of what might happen. Here's Mrs. Merkel. Frau Merkel, in fact, I applaud her. I'm a left person. I'm on the left. But she's the best we have in Europe. She's amazing. Maybe it was because she grew up in East Germany. I don't know. But anyway, yeah. She's amazing. But we have, outside of Merkel, in Hungary, in Poland, in many of the countries of Western Europe, in Turkey and elsewhere, these populist, nationalist, authoritarian movements that are developing. And sometimes democratic countries will find leaders who will appeal to the less educated in their country to create nationalistic anti-immigrant movements, right? And believe me, we have that in the United States as well. We're hoping it will soon be defeated in this country in the upcoming elections, but it may occur. So there are dangers in democracy. Trotsky once said that Stalinism is the syphilis of socialism. Well, populism is the syphilis of democracy. It is a pathological disease that can come along with democracy. And it's very powerful now, egged on by people like Trump and Erdogan and so forth.
So I think this gives us a foundation now to shine light on the biggest mediating actor or aggressor. It's a good question. Russia. So let's put some light. What is Russia's role, firstly, in Russia's interests from a purely historical perspective? I don't want to go beyond the 2016 Blitzkrieg, but we can go all the way back to, say, the evolution and the emergence of the Soviet Union, like how you prefer what you think is relevant to better help to understand the role of Russia.
Russia, the Soviet Union, was a powerful state, and it controlled this continent-large territory, right, including the Caucasus. Eventually, at the end of the Soviet period, as the central government became weaker under Gorbachev, the republics began to find other solutions and eventually became independent, and conflicts developed. Azerbaijan-Armenia conflict, Tajikistan had a civil war, maybe 50,000 died, other frozen conflicts. So the Soviet Union has been unraveling since 1991. It may have disappeared in 1991, but it's been steadily unraveling. And you saw a conflict in 2008 in Georgia. Ossetians, South Ossetians and Abkhaz preferred the Russians to the Georgians. Conflict developed. You saw it in Ukraine. Ukraine is a conflict that was born in the unraveling of the Soviet Union. And in that conflict, Putin, in the Georgian conflict and then in the Ukrainian conflict, Putin made it clear, this is the red line. We're not going beyond this. Ukraine, Georgia will not go into NATO, and we should be a hegemonic power in this area. We should play the major role in this area, right? Okay, they lost the Balkans, the Baltic countries. There's conflict now in Belarus, and again, in Kyrgyzstan, there's some kind of discontent and uprising. And so for our area, for the Caucasus, for the Karabakh conflict, Putin will eventually have to make it clear that this is a place where Russia will make the final decision, right? Now, he's working at the moment through the Minsk group, and he has not, in fact, invoked the treaty of self-defense, mutual defense that he has with Armenia, because that treaty, as he made it clear, says that if Armenia is attacked, Russia will intervene. Armenia has not yet been directly attacked. The fighting is in Azerbaijan. But Putin cannot stand on this ground too long, because ultimately, if he wants to be a Velikiya Derzhava, if he wants to be a great power, if he wants to have some imperial hegemonic role to play in his sphere of influence, which he does, right, then he has to be the one who will bring peace to this area. And that's difficult, but it's essential that he play that role. That may lead to conflict with Turkey. So be it. He's already in conflict with Turkey in Syria and Libya. And also remember one other thing. There's a power we haven't mentioned, and that's Iran. Iran, which is a Shiite Muslim state, you'd think would be close to Azerbaijan, which is a Shiite Muslim state. Not really, but sort of superficially. Islam doesn't play a big role in this. Azerbaijan is a secular state. It's a post-Soviet state. But Iran is sympathetic to Armenia. And that border with Iran is an open border for Armenia. So they have an ally in Iran, but Iran, of course, doesn't want to have conflict with Turkey. It's in a difficult situation since the United States is making aggressive moves toward Iran as much as possible. And there have been recently some threats by Trump himself. So Iran has to be very careful. It's in a difficult position. And Armenia's real ally, Russia, is far away. So the situation is difficult, but I would say Vladimir Putin must finally come to the table and solve this problem, or else his credibility as a deal maker, as a mediator, as a hegemon will be completely disintegrate.
Ronald, what can I say? Such an insightful conversation. So many good points. And one thing it really showed to us, to the audience, is there are solutions. However, it is an extraordinarily complex conflict. Any solution won't be found immediately, and it may still languish on for years to come. But there's hope should remain. Hope should remain to ultimately bring peace to this Nagorno-Karabakh war. So with that being said, our interview is unfortunately at the end. And I would like to thank you for coming today to Faces of Armenia and for your time. And let me know if you have any concluding remarks.
No, thank you. It was a very intelligent conversation. And hopefully we've cleared the way to a better understanding of what's going on in that part of the world. And we must be hopeful, optimistic, because pessimism and cynicism leads to the right, not to solutions, but to repression, war, conflict, things we want to avoid.
With that being said, thank you very much.